This is the Plant Fueled Podcast. My name is Cass Warbeck. I'm a doctor, plant-based athlete, and vegan lifestyle advocate. This podcast is all about sharing conversations that will elevate your performance and your health. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. So I've been vegan for over 10 years now, and I often feel like despite this, I'm just not doing enough. It's so easy to get overwhelmed by the state of the world and feel like change is happening way too slowly. Well, my guest today, Robert Cheek, addresses exactly this. What vegans can do to leverage their own strengths to save more lives and make the biggest difference for animals and the planet. Robert was actually the first guest I ever had on this podcast, so it was my pleasure to welcome him back to discuss the upcoming release of his new book, The Impactful Vegan. As you may know, Robert is sometimes referred to as the godfather of vegan bodybuilding, as he adopted a vegan lifestyle in 1995. Today, he's the author of several books, including the recent New York Times bestseller, The Plant-Based Athlete. He's considered one of the world's most influential vegan athletes and tours the world sharing his story of transformation from a skinny farm kid to champion bodybuilder. In today's conversation, we discussed how to determine your own unique strengths and skills that you can use to be an effective advocate, behind-the-scenes ways to make an impact, what vegan activist strategies might actually be harmful to the movement, and why the green premium is a huge barrier to large-scale change. Thank you for listening, and I hope that following our conversation, you are inspired to learn more about the ways you can make a bigger difference. Welcome back to the podcast, Robert. Thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited. It's been a while since we chatted and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, Cass, thanks for having me. You contributed, as did the others who interviewed me, to my previous book, becoming a New York Times bestseller, a number one international bestseller, and translated into 9 languages. Some of them are behind me here. It's been incredible. And I have to say, my new book, I think is much better. So we'll see what the future holds.
Okay. That's a high standard, because I loved your last book. And I think, like, The Plant-Based Athlete, if for those of you that haven't read it yet, definitely go get a copy. It's truly, like, it's surprising, but there hadn't been a lot of books specifically about that in this space. And I don't know, it definitely filled a void. Your new book, The Impactful Vegan, seems like it's a little bit different from what you've previously written about, but like you're known as a plant-based bodybuilder and the athlete, and this is kind of a new direction. So I'd love to, like, what compelled you to write this one?
Yeah, I would say it's a lot different than my other books. All my other books, I've written five, are about plant-based fitness in one way or another, whether it's a whole food plant-based approach and shredded or vegan bodybuilding, my very first book almost 15 years ago, to, you know, plant-based muscle and the plant-based athlete and all around the same thing. I mean, I published 1,000 pages about building your body on a plant-based diet, but I've always been vegan for the animals. I know I do get the association with me as a plant-based athlete. Of course, I help that narrative as well. But ultimately, I've been vegan for the animals since I was 15 years old, growing up on a farm in Corvallis, Oregon, raising animals myself and selling them at the auction to be turned into someone else's meal. And that's what compelled me to be vegan in the first place. And, you know the rest of the story, and I'll just highlight a few things. I weighed barely 100 pounds when I became vegan. I went on to become a 220-pound champion vegan bodybuilder. I competed in bodybuilding for a decade, won multiple competitions, ended up on magazine covers, filmed a documentary in 2005, wrote a bunch of books on the subject, toured to 5 continents. And what really struck me was that I was always focused on effectiveness and being impactful for animals. I mean, that's why I even chose to go in the direction of building muscle. That was literally the reason back in the mid-1990s or late 1990s when I decided, you know what, I want to build my body without animal protein to show people that they could do the same, and that would in turn help reduce animal suffering and hopefully spare animal lives. That was my altruistic goal from the get-go. And so for 3 decades now, I've been focused on being really impactful for animals. And as I was back on the farm I grew up on a couple of years ago, a few months removed from our last conversation, and with my previous book I co-authored with Matt Frazier, won all these, landed on all these bestseller lists and even won some awards and was in all these languages worldwide. And it was really exciting. I was out on the farm where I grew up on, and I was harvesting walnuts, which I do every fall. And I was out there by myself, just under the trees, by myself, no music, no headphones, very few distractions, just me in nature, where I grew up, contemplating, thinking, brainstorming, and having kind of conversations with myself about what to do next. And I thought, you know what? In my humble opinion, my biased opinion, I'm very good at knowing the impact of one's actions. I mean, look what I did, putting vegan bodybuilding on the map 22 years ago, and what came from that now with Nemai and Tori and Natalie and all these just great vegan bodybuilders, and the fact that it's just grown to the point that a book named The Plant-Based Athlete could be a bestseller among the best and most popular books in the world. And I thought, you know what? I have a lot of ideas, a lot of thoughts, a lot of strategies and principles that I've followed for decades that have been really impactful in ways that I can measure. And very much like The Plant-Based Athlete, where I conducted personally 60 interviews with the world's greatest plant-based athletes, and about 30 or 40 of those stories were in the book, I wanted to do the same with The Impactful Vegan. I thought, you know what? What if I go out? I've got my own ideas. I think I'm pretty competent in this space, but what if I go out and talk to another 30 or 40 world leaders in veganism, in the animal rights movement, in the nonprofit space, in the for-profit vegan company and restaurant space, in the vegan food space, talk to the largest animal sanctuaries, talk to all these different people who are amplifying and promoting veganism in ways that reduce animal suffering in very effective ways, including those who get policy changes made, those who work in the food system, those who have influence on hundreds of millions of animals or even billions. I'd like to talk to those people and learn what they know, what their strategies are, how they have these $50 million annual budgets, and how they use that effectively in some cases for some of these organizations, or other ones, tens of millions, and what kind of changes they're making. So that's what I set out to do. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote 1,000 pages. And obviously a book can't be that long unless you're Michael Greger. So I worked with four or five different editors. I really have two or three books here, to be honest, and who knows what the future holds for some of the content that didn't make it. But we really spent the last year of a 2.5 year process, but the last full year, we started in March of 2022 editing the book. So it's been a full year of editing it, narrowing it down to the best 288 pages or whatever it is to make a compelling case based on data-driven evidence to help animals. And so that's what The Impactful Vegan is all about.
That's amazing. I was so curious the process that went into it, because I'm a huge fan of like your last book. And I really think having the personal interviews, it brings it to, it's not just like this overarching idea. It brings it to like, this is, you take the research, but then you're showing practically how this shows up in the world. And I was curious if you'd follow that similar approach with The Impactful Vegan or not. So I'm so excited to read it eventually. So who is this book written for? That's my first question. Is this book written for people that are already plant-based, or is this like, who's your audience here?
Yeah, that's a question my publisher asked me as well. And I obviously answered it sufficiently enough to land a book deal, but it's still a lot of gray area because we wrestled. I'm talking like a wrestling match for months about what to title this book. We had literally, and I mean that literally, over 100 titles in mind, many of which did not have the word vegan in it, which was kind of my goal. Maybe don't tell my publisher I said that. Because I wanted it to be for anyone who cares about animals and reducing animal suffering. Whether the farmer that actually farms animals and sells them to be slaughtered, but who actually cares about animals. I know it's kind of a weird hypocrisy or juxtaposition, but it's true. I mean, I come from a farm. I have farming family members, relatives, siblings, parents. Like, I know they care about animals. They just have this disconnect as far as a value system of the inherent worth of an animal's life and how that should be treated or respected or disrespected or what have you. So originally, my goal was to have this book for anyone who cares about animals and who would like to help reduce animal suffering. Just like you don't have to be this crazy humanitarian or philanthropist or whatever to care about other people, but you might care about people. And if there's an opportunity to improve someone else's life by just changing your behavior a little bit, or by donating to the right charities, or by using the right language, or by allocating certain resources to help those in need, especially some of the world's poorest people or those in the greatest need of help, you might be persuaded to help them, even if you don't consider yourself a humanitarian or someone who's championing this cause or, you know, pioneering a movement. So I really wanted to reach a broad audience. But at the same time, if you write a book for everyone, you write a book for no one. And that's very common. And as an author, and I've been writing books for a very long time, publishing books for 15 years, but writing for many years before that. And so I know that you've got to, you have to at least have some target demographic in mind. And so who is my audience? Well, they're mostly vegan people. I've been vegan for almost 30 years. Sure, I've got non-vegan friends and followers and readers, but they're mostly people who are vegan. And who are the people who are most likely to take, as you said, the practical application steps to help animals? Well, they're probably other vegans or those who are empathetic or compassionate toward the plight of animals or animal rights causes or animal welfare or charity causes. And so ultimately we decided, you know what? I travel around the world. I mean, my schedule just lately has been totally crazy. I think 4 different countries in the last 2 weeks, and I'm off to another country on Friday, which is a day and a half from now. That's just been that kind of schedule. So I meet a lot of people and I meet a lot of vegans. And quite frankly, sometimes I'm a little bit disappointed or discouraged that other people who subscribe to moral or ethical veganism or that label they attach themselves to are not as effective for the cause as they could be. And in fact, in some cases, and I hate to say it, and some of these are my friends and colleagues or people that I know or have known for a long time, are actually ineffective, even though they subscribe to veganism and they spare, you know, a few hundred animal lives per year themselves, they turn a lot of people away from veganism through their actions, their behavior, their language, their communication, their dogmatic system, their perfectionism, their exclusivity, all kinds of things. And so I actually thought this would be a really helpful book for vegans. And I'm not saying I'm the perfect vegan or anything like that. In fact, I have an entire chapter about that, that perfectionism is actually the enemy. That's not the goal here. The goal is to reduce animal suffering as effectively as possible, not to be the best vegan in the world or the perfect vegan that actually in many cases does not contribute to forward progress, but represents a lifestyle in a certain way that makes it so unattainable for anyone else to even want to consider it. I've seen that firsthand many times. And so that's a long-winded answer to say, ultimately, the book is for anyone who cares about improving the lives of others, because many of these principles can be applied to reducing human suffering as well and improving lives. But it's primarily aimed at a vegan or vegan ally audience who really wants to maximize their advocacy. And it's really a guide to doing that. And it is just like you said, and I appreciate that you love that about the plant-based athlete. It is the data-driven evidence supported by the real-world examples from the Humane League and Farm Sanctuary and the Good Food Institute and Dharma Voices for Animals and Mercy for Animals and all these different Greener by Default and Next Level Burger and all these different entities that I interviewed and talked to who apply the principles and strategies that the data from largely from Faunalytics and Animal Charity Evaluators and other organizations who are domain experts in those areas suggest are most impactful, most effective. So that's who the book is for. And I suspect that's the audience that I'm going to reach, largely because I've been touring to animal rights conferences, vegan festivals, vegan cruises, you know, Planted Expo in Toronto this weekend, the whole thing. That's the audience that I'm engaging with, particularly that animal rights conference or conferences that I'm attending this year and last year, that are really the core demographic of those I'm trying to reach, because they already care and have an emotional connection to wanting to get the most bang for their buck from their outreach. And this is a blueprint essentially on how to do that.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a needed book. And I guess speaking from personal experience is that I'm vegan. I've been vegan for over 10 years now. And sometimes it's like, I want to do more. I want to know how to do more. And what I feel like everyone's good at different things, and there's different ways each of us can be the best advocates. And I'm hopeful that your book maybe will address a lot of different options for people depending on personalities and skills and passions. Because I definitely think it's needed. And one thing I've noticed even within, I guess, the vegan community sometimes is that it's almost like we feel like we're already doing our part by being vegan, that just by being vegan, oh, like I'm doing enough. But I think we can always do better, right? And I think just inspiring people to take that next step to have a bigger impact rather than just like, oh, I'm doing my part, I'm good, is really needed. So I'm curious your thoughts on that. Do you get that impression from vegans as well sometimes?
Yeah, I'm smiling this whole time because I address in detail every single thing you're talking about.
Okay, good.
Let me tell you, Cass, for starters, you're asking about, well, we all have different strengths and talents and you know, different areas of where we're comfortable or expertise or where we shine, where we don't shine. I have one of the foundational concepts of this book is determining our strong V.
Awesome.
That is evaluating our skills, talents, resources, other strengths, network, generosity, and volunteering. There are a lot of things that I suck at, that I'm terrible at, but I sure as hell know my skills and talents. I'm really good at writing. I'm really good at storytelling. I'm really good at marketing those entities. And that's how I travel around the world and make bestseller lists and connect and network with all these different people and all of that stuff. I'm very, very good. I was just with Rich Roll 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Met up with Lewis Howes briefly. So these are some of the most popular podcasters in the world, on the planet. all kinds of interesting people. I was just with Jean Bauer a few days ago, founder of Farm Sanctuary. Like, I'm really good at that kind of stuff, but there's a lot that I'm not good at. And so I actually have this entire section and stories that share examples of tapping into our strong V, which again, I just want to repeat because it's so important. These are our own unique skills and talents and resources, other strengths, network, generosity, and volunteering. And here's a real quick example. I mean, there's many examples in the book, but just a couple. What the heck does that mean? Yep. Strong V, and how does it work in the real world? Mm-hmm. Well, one example I give in the book is that, I don't have a lot of money myself. I wish I did. Maybe if I sell more books, I will. But I don't. But I wanted to help this this fundraising event for a animal sanctuary that is not, it's local, but it's also really impactful. I'm not just playing regional bias favorite because they're 30 minutes away. I mean, they get 5,000 people from the general public to come out for a single one-day event. Sometimes they do education. They do all kinds of outreach besides just rescuing and housing and feeding animals. They're very, very good. It's called Love in Arms. And so I wanted to go to their gala fundraiser event and full transparency, and I hate to admit it, but at the time, a couple of years ago, I could barely even afford the $150 tickets for me and my wife to go. So I contributed $300. Great. Their goal was to raise a couple hundred thousand dollars that in one night. But because of my network, because of my resources that I have, and even my skill set of working with 150 plant-based companies and all the connections that I have, weeks leading up to the event, knowing there was a silent auction, that's how we raise the money. You bid on these auction items. Some are big, like trips, you know, where someone donates their timeshare or whatever, and other things are physical items, apparel, books, sports nutrition products, restaurant gift cards, you name it, all that kind of stuff. A lot of physical items you can bid on. That's where they make the money. So using a few aspects of my strong V, my network, resources, other strengths, and my kind of my skill set, I reached out to lots of companies. And within minutes, you know, sending emails, I had thousands upon thousands of dollars of products donated from companies that wanted to contribute. They get their products out there to be bid on and get their exposure, and they get a kind of a warm glow effect to feel like they're helping and they're donating. At the end of the day, just my contributions alone raised thousands of dollars for the animal sanctuary, where me alone, I didn't have the money. I wasn't in my bank or my wallet, but because of who I'm connected to, I helped us raise, we actually surpassed our goal. We raised 200, I say we as if I'm involved, but the animal sanctuary raised over $200,000 in a single evening. I felt really good about that. Other examples, just really briefly. There's a guy I met at an animal rights conference. I talked to him briefly. I told his story very briefly in the book. He's a web designer. He's very good to the point that he has like 400,000 YouTube subscribers. Like, that's how good he is at what he does. But because he's an ethical vegan, he donates his skills and his resources to build high quality websites for some of the leading animal rights organizations in the world, which saves them tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in labor and costs and wages and all that, which also means they're statistically likely to have probably a better website and receive more donations as a result and reach more people and all of that. So he's using his skill set, his talents, and his community and network to, he's not paying any money. It's not costing him money, just like it didn't cost me any money either to raise thousands. It just was, we're tapping in to our network. Another really brief story, because it's right down the road. We have this dinner theater, Broadway style performances, you know, the biggest shows you can think of that are on Broadway that are performed here in Northern Colorado in this really nice theater that seats around 300 people that has shows nightly and two shows on weekends. My wife and I first started going a few years ago, not a single vegan item on the menu, nothing. Vegetarian, we had to make substitutions and all of that. So we went a time or two, and we love theater. So it was really interesting for us. So we filled out comment cards about having vegan options. And then we actually met with the theater manager. She was friendly and talking about being season ticket holders and all that. And we became season ticket holders. We filled out comment cards. And sure enough, you know, they have a new show every 3 months or so, because each show runs for a few months. And sure enough, like a few months down the road, they had vegan menu items, you know, for every single person who wanted them, hundreds of people nightly. And furthermore, the woman who's the manager got up on stage and she said, you know, we take your comment card seriously, your comment seriously. And she pointed at us and said, because of our season ticket holders over there who are vegans, we now have vegan items on the menu for everyone to enjoy. And she probably not only said that night in front of hundreds of people, but probably, you know, other times too. And in fact, I gave that example in the book like a year and a half ago when I wrote it, but we were just there a few weeks ago. And guess what? Multiple vegan menu items now on the menu. And we still go every few months, but it's just getting better. The menu items become more popular. Now they have a vegan dessert item. And once again, on stage, she said it again. Because we thanked her again. And she's like, for our vegans over there and for, you know, vegans throughout the venue, we have these options for you. So what did that take? That took just a little bit of our time, our generosity, our thoughtfulness, our persuasive communication. And so I give, and there's many, many more stories, and I know we want to move on, but that is a key part of the book, is that you are way more connected than you realize. You have access to far greater resources than you think you do. You have skills that you may not even be aware of. You have inherent talents that you're born with that you may not be using to leverage to help animals. And my book asks a lot of questions, and it helps you identify where you are most effective. That's why I write books. I'm one of the best. And I say this, you know, hopefully with no ego attachment. I'm just one of the best at doing it. I'm not as good at being a bodybuilder. I was okay as a bodybuilder. I'm so much better writing about it. You know, let Tori Washington, Natalie Matthews, and others perform on stage and let me amplify them and promote them. I'm better behind the scenes. I'm a decent presenter. You know, let me be on stage and talk about these things where other people may not be able to shine quite as brightly. And I'll get out of the way in areas where I'm just not as good and not as effective. And so we can all identify that about ourselves and therefore put our best foot forward for the animals. And then there was another comment you made that I was also smiling and nodding to. I can't remember what it was now, but my book covers that, whatever it was.
covers that. All good. I'm so excited to read this. And I love all those examples you shared because they're just all in such different domains. That was going to be one of my questions. And I think you answered it. It's like, well, what about people that are naturally more introverted? Like myself, I find I'm not a great speaker. I don't like love posting huge things and getting in people's faces about veganism. And you don't need to, based on everything that you're sharing. Everyone has inherent skills. And like the web designer you shared, like that's such a quiet behind the scenes like videographer contribution that he's doing, yet it's impacting like thousands. So I think that's really cool and something to think about and just like shift the perspective from the traditional vegan advocate that's like standing by roads holding signs to like tailoring it more to like what you're good at, what you're passionate about. And
also what the data, just to really quickly interject, mm-hmm. and also what the data suggests is the most effective. So for you,
that was going to be more of my questions.
Right. So you're more introverted, whatever, writing letters to the editor or writing informational articles and submitting them to popular websites where you can reach millions. I mean, I've been featured in the New York Times and in all these major newspapers. It just takes a little bit of time and effort. It's not as sexy sometimes. Like I know social media and, you know, look at me and all this stuff and it's cool. Like, and I get caught into that. I was posting photos of me and Rich Roll like probably yesterday. And it's like, yeah, the ego boost and all that. But really many of our most effective ways, and I don't know if I should give them away in the interview or not, but you know, either way, they're in the book. They're even ranked based on, you know, survey data, what actually encourages most non-vegans to, you know, come to veganism or be open to it or to change their behavior and actions and all that. And a lot of it is the not sexy stuff, the writing articles and reaching thousands or millions through print articles, through opinion letters, through thoughtful dialogue and through other behind the scenes work, writing bills for policy change and writing to schools about allergens and, you know, removing dairy from, you know, certain curriculums and all that. There's so much effective stuff you can do, or even simply like you work for a company. And I mean, I didn't even make it to the book, but there's a friend I work for who works for a major company and got them to include vegan food in their corporate offices, which it's a massive, massive national company that everybody would know the name of. But those kind of things we can all do behind the scenes that don't even cost us money, or we don't have to have a big following or tons of influence. There's so much we can do that is super efficacious. And the book, again, outlines all those things for every personality type, even if you have zero followers and are not on social media at all. I mean, you could even use your physical strength to volunteer at animal sanctuaries and move hay bales and carry buckets and help out and, you know, make introductions to people, connect this person to this person who then can help with this or bring in funds for this, or they can help connect you with the president of this company. There's so much of that stuff, and it's all in the book. Like I said, over 1,000 pages. We just picked the best 288 because I've even told you there's some great stories. Five chapters completely removed. That's why I think there might be another book down the road.
Volume two.
Because there's so many stories and examples that didn't even make it in that are still very helpful.
Yeah, no, that's huge. My mind is like spinning right now with all things, even for me personally. Like, I've always been a huge like lead by example, like just let my veganism show for itself in jiu-jitsu and MMA, and even getting like as a resident physician, like trying to like breach it with my patients and things like that. And obviously having the podcast, but I think, yeah, I'm excited to kind of take it to the next step myself personally. And yeah, very excited to read. One thing I want to touch on, and you had mentioned previously a little bit, and I think it's probably important to talk about a little bit, is you mentioned that there's approaches that aren't actually helpful, that could even be harmful to the vegan movement. And I just would love you to share a couple of these examples or the couple of the major things for people to watch out for when it comes to kind of putting people off a plant-based diet.
Yeah, this is a touchy subject. And I know there's certain sections of the book that some vegans are going to struggle with. And they might even be upset with me, even though it's data that I'm referencing. It's not my opinion. I'm like looking at the data and evidence. But I think what we have to do is take a step back and remove all of our personal biases. I mean, that's what this whole book is about. It's about listening to the evidence and the data and the experts and saying, you know, I don't know what I don't know, and I don't know as much as I think I know. And that's even me as an author and vegan of 30 years saying that there's a lot that I don't know, including about effectiveness. And that's why I wrote the book and why I interviewed so many people, so I could learn more. And boy, did I learn a lot. And that's what you'll see in the conclusion of the book. The final chapter is all the things that I learned and changed my mind about. So maybe I should start by asking you some questions. I've been listening to countless hours of psychology podcasts. I'm certainly not an expert, but I've probably been exposed to more of it than most lately for the better part of a year or two. And I think what we have to do is take a step back and think about the things that influence us and turn us on or turn us off to something. Like what makes us receptive to something or to really feel a little bit distant. And so some of these are quite obvious that as far as just from a psychological standpoint, if someone is screaming at you, demanding that you change your worldview, knowing nothing about you or your background or your history or cultural background or your tendencies or your habits or anything like that, but just, you could even be at a shopping mall somewhere. You could just be out and about. And someone is screaming at you, questioning your morals, your ethics, questioning you as a person. Demanding that you change your behavior, and for good reason, you know, passionate that, you know, about the plight of animals and the billions that are suffering and all of that. But are you very likely to change your worldview immediately and say, you know what, this person screaming at me and perhaps even calling me names and challenging my moral compass, yeah, I want to join them. I want to just completely change my paradigm shift here, worldview, my value system overnight, and I want to be screaming at other people now. That's the club that I want to be part of. It doesn't tend to work like that. You can look at organized religions, who do that, how effective that is when that behavior is done. You can look at the fact that when we're overtly judgmental and publicly judgmental about individuals, it's okay to be critical, but when we're kind of judgmental and especially in kind of abrasive or aggressive ways, is that a way to invite people to be part of our club or part of our team or part of our winning attitude or part of our optimism and all that? I would say probably not. If I see you, these are just some examples that come to mind. If I see you and I don't really like what you're wearing, I suspect it's real fur. It appears to be. And I throw a bunch of red paint on you and call you names. Are you now going to change your dietary patterns, which is ultimately what matters, what we put on the end of our fork or on our plates, because that affects supply and demand of the food system where 99.9% of animal suffering takes place. Do you have this epiphany as I'm yelling at you and throwing paint on you that, you know what? That's right, I should go vegan. Like, where do I sign up? Now, Cass, the problem is, it's a psychological problem. The problem is, as a vegan advocate, when I'm out there yelling and screaming and fighting and demanding, I am the voice for the voiceless. I feel empowered. I am doing what others are unwilling to do. I am speaking for the animals. I am making a difference. Or am I? Or am I feeding my own ego, my own identity, my own label system? Getting support from my peer group is not challenging me. And celebrating this within an echo chamber of those who are going to pat me on the back. And am I actually turning people away from a movement that would otherwise welcome them with a different approach that's more warm and palatable? An example, I just, this is not in the book. I just saw this on Instagram, I believe, just recently. There was somebody, again, I guess I'm being critical here, but this is an observation. And maybe I can ask you what you think about it. I saw someone who posted that they were out holding a sign. They were protesting something. I don't know. Let's say they had factory farm footage or animal cruelty on their sign in a town square or something. It was somewhere outside the U.S., I believe. But they were holding the sign and said, after 2 hours, only one person stopped by to talk to them. But they're just going to keep moving forward, keep fighting the good fight, and all this kind of stuff. And then I read the comments because this is, you know, what I do. I'm curious what works, what doesn't work, and all that. And keep standing your ground. I'm proud of you. High five. You know, you're doing the Lord's work, whatever. And my thought was, what a profound waste of time.
That's what I was thinking too.
2 hours and you had one person stop, and maybe even a lot of other people were like, you know, I don't know, stay away from that person or whatever. There may have been some other vibe going on. I mean, how is that even possible that only one person would stop after 2 hours? Of course, I know the answer because I've done some of that myself, including while writing this book. It's very uncomfortable for me, mm-hmm. even as someone who's totally passionate about helping animals, to the fact that I even got kicked out of class in high school by, you know, shouting about animal rights and stuff and blaming my classmates for the contributions to animal suffering they contribute to. It's very uncomfortable for me to go out there and hold signs and hold videos, but I did it anyway. And I also had one, two, or three conversations over a multi-hour period. And I was thinking, there were so many other effective approaches that we know based on data and evidence and surveys and observation and anecdotal stories and trial and error and success from organizations that work. So is it a good idea to spend our time doing things that actually turn people off? I would argue no, but it empowers us. I know I've been in animal rights marches, and you feel empowered, you know, strength in numbers, people all around me marching through the streets of LA, you know, and then it was time to like go into Whole Foods and start shouting at customers. And I just kind of sat that one out. You know, I was holding signs and doing, you know, someone leads it with a megaphone and chant, and you follow their chant and what they're saying, and it's kind of fun. And you take photos for social media and videos, and you feel like it gives you street cred, and you know, it boosts your morale and your ego. That's a big word. Ego is a big one. It boosts ego, and all this stuff. But then when it came, when the rubber hit the road, when it's like, okay, now we're going into Whole Foods, we're going to yell at people in the seafood section. I'm like, ah, that's not for me, because I think of my parents or my in-laws or my neighbors, nice people, but they eat animals. And is that going to help get them, you know, finally push them over the edge, being screamed at in a grocery store to join the right side of history? Data suggests that's not the way to go. And I know I'm going to get some flack from this. I know some of the most popular vegan advocates in the world do a lot of that. And yes, there is some good that comes from it. They're able to disrupt and slow down slaughterhouse trucks. They're able to get news stories and raise awareness. You know, these protesters shut down this whatever and makes the news. And we do know that news stories are effective. So there are some good things that come from it. But when it comes from individual advocacy and activism and actions, some of those things that we do turn people away, including, and I've seen this a lot in over the years, our own language and conversation, where some of my friends who are very staunch, aggressive advocates for animals will basically just say, you're an idiot. You're a complete moron if you're not vegan. What a loser. I don't know about you, but the last time people called me that, I didn't exactly enthusiastically jump to join their team to be a real winner. It just doesn't work that way in most of human psychology. And so what we have to do are these other more effective proven strategies, including leading by positive example, even though it's not super sexy and it's not always cool represent anything with tons of optimism and positivity and give information to people and help others out and answer their questions and lead as a positive role model and do all these different things. But that works, which is why challenges like Veganuary and these 30-day challenges, which are super supportive and support networks, and we got people to answer your questions and registered dietitians on board and chefs and all these people to help out, like, that really helps. And so we've got to look at not what our own biases say and not what makes us feel empowered. Animals don't care why people stop eating them. They just care that they stop. And there's a lot of ways to get to that solution. And I think my book, The Impactful Vegan, paints a very helpful picture on how to get to that end result.
Yeah, you spoke about that very, very beautifully. And it makes so much sense when you lay it out like that. Like, it's obvious when you think about it in those like black and white terms. It's like, we want to move towards positivity. We don't want people saying, like, criticizing our deep values and our priorities. And because I think deep down, most people are good people and they want to do the right thing. And some people just need to see it differently. So I completely agree with everything you said. And something I think a lot about is when I originally went vegan, like 10 years ago, like, what was it? It wasn't the videos or the protests or anything. It was simply like opening my mind to information and reading a few books and understanding more about the movement. And ultimately it was a positive movement for me towards something better, not away from something bad. Yeah, I think that's huge. So I appreciate you speaking about that. And I think even on social media, I think there's a lot of posts that are just more going for shock factor, not necessarily talking to people in a way that they understand. I want to touch on non or for-profit vegan businesses, because I think you touch a little bit on how it's important to support like vegan businesses. And I think that's one way that is easy to do, like make these choices with our money, essentially. So do you want to just talk on that real briefly?
Yeah, that's actually, believe it or not, it's a more complicated topic.
Oh, okay.
And it raises some eyebrows when I say things like, in some ways, in some circumstances, all things being equal, which is a pretty empty statement. Most things are not equal, but all things being equal, in many cases, it's better to support non-vegan restaurants than vegan restaurants.
Oh, is it? Okay. See, that's interesting. I would love to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah. In many ways, because vegan restaurants are mostly going to cater to vegan people. They already have their demographic. They already have their audience. They know who's going there. Mm-hmm. But when you go to large scale national chains or multinational chain restaurants, and you support the vegan items that are on the menu, these chains have thousands of locations compared to like the most popular vegan chain in the world has like 200 locations. Mm-hmm. And they're mostly in Taiwan. That's Loving Hut. They've got like 35 in the US. And Next Level Burger just acquired Veggie Grill. They have 27. They're like the next biggest chain. 27. There's 45,000 Subways, right? Okay. there's 38,000 McDonald's or whatever, on down the line. I have all the lists. I have all the charts. You know, I know all the order, you know, Starbucks, KFC, Domino's, whatever. I know the order of, but also these family diners, you know, that we all know, the Applebee's and, you know, Cheesecake Factories of the world and all that. All things being equal, in many cases, it can be more valuable to patronize those restaurants to ensure that their plant-based items, their vegan menu items are popular, are requested, are purchased, and stay on the menu so they're available, or else they'll be completely removed based on supply and demand. And that happens actually, unfortunately, too often. And furthermore, there are all kinds of omnivores who, for many reasons, whether listening to a podcast like this, or reading a book, or seeing a billboard, or seeing a social media post, or reading a news article, who will opt to get the plant-based option at a regular mainstream restaurant. Just like that dinner theater I was at, there was a random couple next to us at the table, and they ordered the vegan option there.
Awesome.
They weren't vegan, but they were compelled to order it. It wasn't because of our influence either. They picked that independently. And then the table next to us, they had the vegan option. Again, these weren't possible without me and my wife requesting that in the first place. Mm-hmm. But then you need to be, those have to be supported because there's a risk. Like just using that dinner theater, go back for a quick second. Yeah. There's a risk that if it was only me and my wife, we're the only two ordering. Who cares if we're season ticket holders? It's a supply and demand. If no one else is ordering the vegan items, they take it off. They get it off the list. But because the item is there, people tend to support it. There's data that backs this up as well. Greener by Default did some of this stuff, that when you put plant-based on the menu, there's a percentage of people who will order it. But if it's not on the menu, those same people won't ask for it. It's too much trouble. It's too much work. And you're like, you feel uncomfortable. You're the token vegan. Oh, do you happen to have this? It becomes an ordeal with your family and friends who are non-vegan. But if it's already there on the menu, and guess what else happens? Let's take my wedding. For example, we had a very small wedding, just a handful of friends. But that night we went to a regular restaurant and just due to the nature of where we were having the wedding. You know, a number of people in our wedding party, almost all of them who are non-vegans, ordered the vegan item just, you know, to support me and my wife. And that happens when you go out in groups all the time. When you go to a typical omnivorous restaurant, this happened on St. Patrick's Day a couple of days ago. I was out with my brother and a bunch of his friends for his birthday party. My brother happens to be vegan. I'm vegan. My wife is vegan. There were 10 of us, 8 or 10 or 12 of us total at the dinner. And a bunch of people ordered the vegan item again at a regular, it was even called vegan burger on the menu at this regular restaurant. That's important. Whereas you have to look at this, there's this neglect factor. So that's a key thing in my book and in other books about effective altruism and such, that a lot of vegan restaurants, if they're established, there's not a huge neglect factor because vegans gravitate toward them. They're going to have a core audience, but the plant-based or vegan menu items at mainstream restaurants are often neglected. Mm-hmm. That's why they're kicked off of A&W or Tim Hortons, or trying to give some Canadian references here. Hold on. Where's my, hold on. There we go.
I like it. He's waving the Canadian flag.
Yeah, he's waving the Canadian flag. This is like my third Canadian podcast this week. And I have these available here.
Amazing.
Yeah, I forgot to do it in the last one. But so that's a difficult thing for people to swallow, right? Because they're like, no, I want to give my money to only vegan restaurants. You have no idea what people are doing with it. Mm-hmm. Like, people have this thing like, I'm only going to support vegan restaurants. Well, then apparently you don't ever go to a grocery store, ever. Or you don't realize that if you're paying with a credit card, you're also paying a certain fee that goes to the credit card company. And also the vegan restaurant, what are they doing with your money? They're paying utilities. They're paying their non-vegan landlord. Like, we have this perfectionist idealism in our head that I'm only going to support this and it's going to be perfect. No, it's not. That doesn't make any practical sense whatsoever, which is why it didn't make it into the book, but I had a whole chapter on that in many ways, it makes sense to support non-vegan restaurants, to vote with your dollars, to create more demand. And I've seen it firsthand myself. I've been part of that revolution. I've demanded, not through verbal, but through my purchase power, I've demanded that vegan items stay on the menu. Furthermore, and I don't have my things here, I have these business cards that I leave when I pay the bill, credit card or receipt, that says something like, I dined here because you have vegan options. I ate here because, and so we leave them at non-vegan restaurants. These are just little business cards, and it thanks them for having vegan options and say, that's why I came here. You can also say that verbally, or you can even write it on the receipt, like, thank you for having vegan options. That's why we chose to come here today. And so when you have those vegan options at mainstream restaurants, you can bring a group of omnivores who may drag their feet to go to a vegan restaurant and may not want to be at an all-vegan restaurant. But when they see the plant-based options, and including even shared menu, you know, starters or whatever you can share as a whole group, they're likely to order plant-based stuff when the options are there in an environment that they're comfortable in. I'll just share one last example. I even had a friend who was so new to veganism, or veganism was so distant to him, I should say. He was such a non-vegan. He actually felt uncomfortable. He didn't know what to, you know, because he felt dumb. He didn't know what tempeh was or tofu this, or if it says it's a burger, but it's made out of quinoa or black beans. He was very uncomfortable. And so oftentimes allowing people to be comfortable and meet them where they're at, but still encouraging them to order plant-based foods, but in an environment that they're a little bit more familiar with, can be a really good thing. And that's why I'm a big supporter of a lot of international restaurants. Yeah, I hate the fact that a lot of international restaurants have all kinds of animals on their menu, but they have entire dedicated vegan sections or plant-based sections. We're talking about Indian food and Thai food and Vietnamese food and Mexican food and Japanese food, Ethiopian food. I do think it's important to voice a perspective that influences supply and demand. So I know it's a much bigger topic than you anticipated, Cass. Like, oh yeah, we should go. My quick answer would be like, yeah, if you want the vegan restaurant to stay in your town, go support it.
Mm-hmm. Right? But there's also a time and place to go to these other restaurants too. Yeah,
exactly. And restaurants do need support right now. There is a struggling that's happening in the current economy, not just vegan restaurants, although those are on our radar. So we think it's like, that's our personal bias. Like, why are all these vegan restaurants closing? No, all restaurants are closing, like across the board. It's not just vegan restaurants. There's just restaurant closures because of, post-pandemic inflation and high economic costs and high rent that's skyrocketing and higher food prices and less food availability to order ingredients and all that. So it's still very important. It's very important to support vegan restaurants. So just don't overlook the importance of voting with your dollars at other restaurants too, to ensure that they will keep vegan menu items for anyone to order all year round when they serve exponentially more customers than the small little vegan entities do.
Yeah. I have a very quick follow-up question to that. And it's just in regards to the non-dairy milk upcharge that's common at Starbucks and places like that, where they'll charge an extra 80 cents or so if you want the non-dairy milk alternative. And I know some vegans are very like, oh, boycott Starbucks because they charge extra. And I think there's even a bit of a lawsuit going on in the States right now because they're saying it discriminates or takes advantage of people's lactose intolerance. What are your thoughts on that? Like, personally, I go to Starbucks all the time and I order my soy matcha. Is there any data on that? Like, I feel like Starbucks wouldn't even notice if I didn't go there.
They are the fourth, maybe even third now, largest fast food chain in the world. They don't like to be called fast food. I know I have a friend who works for their corporate office and he doesn't like that. But they are, they have between 30 and 40,000 locations, I believe. I used to have all the numbers memorized, but they're big. So they likely wouldn't notice anything. They know who their core audience is. They know who 99, maybe 0.9% of their customers are. We have to think about the real numbers. I think it's a noble cause, and I think it could make a significant difference if they reduce that charge, or if they reduce dairy milk options and have more plant milk options, which I know some smaller coffee shop chains that are still chain locations with many locations are doing. That can have an impact on supply and demand of dairy milk being used. But I think it's also, you know, I have to be very careful because I'm friends with the people who are heading that up. In fact, I'm going to be on their podcast soon. I have to be very careful how I word it, but I also think there's a lot of, how do I even say this? I don't know, more like personal bias or agenda, or maybe even a little bit of ego driving that it may not make that big of a difference. There may be more effective things that we can do, or some more low hanging fruit, or we can have a larger impact, or these other things. So I don't really have a good solid answer. I haven't seen what the data is or what the numbers are. And that's why I'm kind of wishy-washy, because I think you have to be, if you don't know a good solid answer. Like, there's a lot of things I do know the answers to because the data is there and we know the survey results. We know what the evidence says. That one, I just don't know. But I also look at it like, I mean, I know friends who are there, like literally a friend I saw 2 days ago is one of the main people out there doing some of the protesting at Starbucks and is working with the major organization that's leading that. And again, I have to look at the optics too. Like, what do a lot of omnivores, how does that make vegans look as far as, like, does that make me want to go dairy free myself, or is it a little bit more extreme or whatever? So I think there's an optics case going on too, that vegans, I think, view as very positive publicity. But a lot of people might view as negative. I mean, we know that a young activist was just arrested at Starbucks the other day, a week or two ago. And you know, that, again, we have to take our own bias out. And I know this guy, I know this young person, or at least I've met him. So I have to take my own bias out. What does the mainstream say? Well, he got what he deserved, right? He's out there protesting and getting in the way and disrupting commerce. And because we live in this capitalistic society, a lot of special Americans don't play by the rules. And does protesting and getting arrested and all this stuff move the needle? Or does it give us a badge of honor that look at the result of what happened to me because I stood up for this cause? Again, I don't know what the answer for all of this stuff is. How does it change the behavior of the general public? That's the answer to everything in the Impactful Vegan, because we are the 2%. We're the 1% globally. We're maybe the 2 or 3% in North America who identify as vegans. How do we appeal to the 98%? And not only appeal to them, one of my slogans is, we can't just change hearts and minds. We also have to change menus and meal plans. You can't just, as Paul Shapiro beautifully says in the book, you can't just win arguments with non-vegans. You have to win them over. And some of our, what I think are a little bit of self-serving tactics may not be winning people over. It wins us popularity. It wins us likes and comments on social media. And I'm guilty of that too. But is it winning over the 98%? That should always be in the back of our minds. In anything that we do, are we winning people over? I know I still make mistakes sometimes. I post memes that I know are a little bit, they're going to rub omnivores the wrong way. And I'm kind of doing it on purpose to bother them, to make them think differently. But is it having a positive result? Maybe not. And so then I reflect and say, okay, I'm going to post more positive memes that can go viral, or posts that could go viral, rather than one that's more inflammatory, because anytime someone feels attacked or inflamed or targeted, they're less likely to join the opposition. That's just not how humans behave, or at least not in typical societies. And I think at the end of the day, we always have to keep that in mind, which is why it probably caught people off guard when I said, yeah, go to non-vegan restaurants. What are you talking about, Robert? I'm not going to give my money to them. Well, you're going to grocery stores, you know, that sell dead animals throughout the whole store, and you're giving your money to them. You're going to the gas station. You're giving your money to these evil corporations that run the fuel system. You're shopping at, you're buying clothes that are made in sweatshop labors, 99% guaranteed, unless you're super altruistic at reading every single thing you ever purchase, which I used to as a young person. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. We're hypocritical in everything that we do. So we need to pick the areas that do the most good, reduce the most suffering, and go there. And sometimes our actions may not be in alignment with the end result that we're hoping for, but we get blinded by the fact that it's self-serving in a lot of ways because it's empowering. And I don't want to take that away. If we need people to feel empowered and motivated, inspired, I just think there's a lot of other ways to feel that way too.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think you explained that really well. And I think just always considering the perspective of who you're trying to change is a good way to just take a step back and just evaluate your actions from like that bigger perspective rather than just like in the moment. So very important takeaway. I have just a couple more questions I'd love to ask you.
Sure, and I'll try to be quicker. I know this is a theme in every podcast.
You're an excellent talker. You just like articulate your ideas so well. And I think that's part of what makes you an excellent writer. So I appreciate it. But you mentioned earlier on that doing these interviews and all this research that you actually changed your mind on a couple things and that you were doing in your own life. And I would love to just hear like maybe one example of one of the things that stands out to you that you've shifted or have done differently after the experience of writing this book.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I think the first that comes to mind perhaps is considering the green premium that Bruce Friedrich talks about. He's the founder or maybe co-founder of the Good Food Institute. He's the president of the Good Food Institute. They're doing a lot of progressive work for preparing the future for cultivated meat and for alternative proteins, precision fermentation, all kinds of alternative protein foods. They work with foreign governments. They're one that I alluded to with a $50 million annual budget. They employ hundreds of people. They work in areas, they have offices in, I don't know, 5 or 6 countries on multiple different continents, from India to Brazil and around the world. They do a lot of forward thinking work. But they brought up this idea, Bruce brought up this idea of the green premium, that there's a very small subset of individuals, a lot of people like us, who are willing to overpay for plant-based burgers that are in some places literally $15 on the menu, $17 on the menu, $20 on the menu. I know, I just ordered one 3 days ago on St. Patrick's Day. In fact, I ordered two. I dropped like $50 on two burgers, ridiculous. But that's because I'm vegan, I'm ethically in line. I'm just gonna, 98% of people will not stand for that. No, a burger is $2 because of the government subsidies and because of the cheap costs involved. But those of us who are plant-based or environmentalists or vegans or whatever, we are going to be the early adopters for electric cars and pay $150,000 for a Tesla before the price gets dropped down to $30,000 for a lower base model. We are the ones who are going to use solar power and alternative energy and all of that. And we are the ones that are going to overpay for plant-based proteins and alternative proteins. But 98% of people won't. And it's very sobering. I even read it just recently. I was reviewing the book for a lot of podcasts and stuff. And he even said, I actually wrote in the book, I said something along the lines of, the following statement is even hard for me to write because of whatever it is, of how detrimental it is to our society moving forward. Or it wasn't it, it was actually more eloquent. But what I was about to write was that there's 11 peer-reviewed studies or 11 peer-reviewed papers that say animal agriculture is going to grow by anywhere from 62% to 252% by 2050. We are going to be killing more animals than ever before on a massive scale. That's what all the data suggests. Unless we can drop the green premium and bring the cost and convenience, and in our case, food, the taste down. So you can't bring the taste of a Tesla down or solar down. But basically, I don't know, there's only a few houses in the neighborhood that have solar panels. It's just, it's, you know, kind of the weird people, right? Just our either wealthy or our kind of crazy vegan friends that have the Teslas, or at least, you know, in most places outside of California. And it's really just your vegan friends and those who are willing to pay the $17 plant-based burger, or the $6 vegan cheeses, or you name it, the $9 vegan butter, whatever it is. So what I learned is that we are not going to get there unless we get governments involved, we raise billions of dollars, and we prepare societies for a different future. Basically, and this was a difficult, Bruce was the number one person I wanted to interview. There, I had a list of wish lists, and I got almost all of them. A couple I didn't get to. I got almost everybody. Bruce was my number one. He actually even denied at first. He declined. Then I told him, I said, man, you were number one on my list. He said, okay, we'll do it. Make it quick though. So, and no follow-up questions, but then he did follow up. And then I met him in person, sat down with dinner with him. Hey, he's great. But at first he didn't have the time for me. But basically his point was that we have to prepare consumers, we have to prepare retailers, we have to prepare governments to have these products that are more accessible. So we have to, whether it's a psychological perspective where people have to be willing to embrace cultivated meat and alternative proteins and understand that's just how meat is made. We have to improve taste quality, you know, before it's available for everybody, because if you get it out there too early, and that's what's happening a little bit with Beyond Meat and some other companies where it's omnivores don't love it and they're not coming back a second time or a third time or fourth time. And then it's just got to be everywhere. You can't, look at the number one vehicle in America by far, and it's not even close, is the Ford F-150 pickup. They're everywhere. Teslas are a little hard to find, especially throughout middle America. You'll get them on the coasts and all that. So basically, we're not going to get to the future that we want unless some serious changes are made. And Bruce suggested some of those things. And that's what made that interview a little bit eye-opening and difficult, is that we're really heading in a worse direction. Like, you think it's bad now, you know, just wait till we have 10 billion people in 2050, which is projected. Why is that bad? Well, I addressed that early on in the book, that our population growth is so significant, and based on real statistics globally, when you factor in the whole planet, 99% of people are non-vegans. You know, it's pretty obvious. Look at 8 billion people. In order to get even to 1%, you'd have to be really high. The hundreds of millions, we're not there. And so think about that. 99% of every new baby born, the next 2 billion people being born in the next 25 years to get to 2050, are going to be omnivores, eating animals. We're on a very, very bad trajectory. And it was very sobering, and it was eye-opening that we need to, basically my takeaway was, we need to invest in innovative food technology. And Bruce is doing that. Paul Shapiro is doing that with the Better Meat Co. There are 1,300 alternative protein companies working to do that. And the answer isn't necessarily, in fact, multiple people said, which was again surprising, I learned, that plant-based meat is not the solution, that maybe cultivated meat is the solution, that some people are just not willing to eat plants in place of meat. They want real animal cells, real animal tissue. And we can do that in very low cruelty ways through cultivated meat, where cruelty is not completely eliminated, but drastically eliminated. And so so that was something that I learned, that that we've got to take certain actions to reduce the green premium. And that is oftentimes where, again, we're blinded by, because we have no problem paying extra for what we want. But 99% of our friends will not do it. And if you don't get mass adoption, you're never going to get there. Basically, it won't happen. This vegan future we all want, it won't happen unless we take these incremental steps to get there. And it's not the steps that we think. It's not changing one upcharge or yelling at people on the street or demonizing our friends or alienating people. It is doing whatever we can to work with governments to lower some of the subsidies or lower some of the costs and increase, you know, work with public health professionals and increase awareness of plant-based foods and their benefits on public health, which is, you know, multi-trillion-dollar industry that's going to be bankrupt, you know, any day now if we continue to have heart disease as a number one killer, and also dementia, which is the most expensive disease by far. It's not even close. $380 billion or so compared to heart disease, which is only 100 and something billion. Dementia, Alzheimer's, which again can be in some ways linked back to diet and lifestyle, is three times more expensive than anything else that we face. We've got to tackle all of those things. How do we do it? Well, again, we outline a lot of those strategies in the book, and so do the experts that I interviewed. And I'm hoping this book plays some sort of small role in that, allocating, hopefully, at the end of the day, millions of dollars into the most effective animal charities, where the Good Food Institute can go ahead and go out and do their work to work with governments and change the system so we have a brighter future. So organizations like the Humane League, who can spare a chicken's life or improve a chicken's life for as little as 33 cents, can go out there and continue to impact hundreds of millions of birds that have a desire to live a life free of fear, pain, and suffering, just like you and I do. And we can invest into Faunalytics, who does the research studies that lets us know what works and what doesn't work. So we can reallocate our time and effort and realize that our time is better spent doing this than that. It's better doing A than B. That's what we have to do. And that's what I covered, what I think beautifully. I mean, it sounds so bizarre. I don't know if other authors do this, but like, I read my own book and like, I don't want to put it down, even though I wrote it and I've read it like 20 times. I'm reading it again right now and I'm about to finish it. I got another 70 pages to go or so. I'm going to finish it on my flight to Toronto on Friday. Actually, no, I got like 50 pages left. I'm almost there. And like, I can't get enough of it because I learned something. I mean, there I am right now. Conscious Capitalism for Better Business, you know, The Vegan Career, an entire chapter about that. Infographics that are super helpful and tell a story. The power of technology, reducing animal suffering it's in the palm of your hand and leveraging some of those strategies. Infographics about the most effective ways to reduce animal suffering based on real data. That's all there. I'm just flipping through this for those who aren't watching on video. There's a one that you like, leading by example. What actions make the most difference? Amazing. I mean, that's like the Vegan Strong method, you know? So it's good. Like that's, I mean, using your financial power for good, change you can believe in. Like that's what this book is going to do. And if I do my job well, which is articulating the book and selling copies and getting it out there, it really will raise tremendous awareness and funds for those organizations that are doing the most good. And I haven't even mentioned by name some of the ones that are actually doing the most good. I'll save that for readers, but there's a few that I haven't even touched on that are doing. One, for example, is feeding 1 million vegan meals to hungry children in the developing world every single day right now. Like just during this conversation, they just fed what's the math on that? They just fed like 50,000 meals just now during this conversation. And they've been doing it for 46 years, I think. And they've fed 8.6 billion vegan meals in 65 countries to those who are otherwise starving or would eat low quality, low grade animal-based food they could get their hands on. That's one organization. In fact, I'm donating a vegan meal to a Hungry Child with every book sold in my collaboration with that organization. I haven't even talked about them yet in an hour and 15 minutes with you. That's how much is in this book. So I hope people get it.
I'm amazing. I'm totally convinced. I pre-ordered it a long time ago, so I cannot wait to read it. You're doing phenomenal work. When does the book officially get released? And where is there a specific place you want to direct people to pre-order, or like, does it matter where they purchase the book from, in other words?
Great question. June 25th, 2024. So a few months from now,
so comes close. Out
a book in every bookstore in North America. It will be in a few other languages coming soon, but not yet. It'll just be in North America first in English. And so you can order from anywhere. I'm going to Canada, so I just happened to look, and my book is currently, it's the number one ranked hot new release in the animal rights category, which means it probably sold 3 copies. Like that's how we, you know, it's tiny category, animal rights, and I'm a hot new release. I probably sold like 3 copies yesterday to earn my number one spot. But Amazon rankings matter, but also, mm-hmm. If you don't like supporting Amazon, I also suggest that that's like, you know, boycotting the grocery store. Amazon is
here to stay.
Not that much different. Not that much different than other bookstores. You can support the independent bookstore, which is like the vegan restaurant equivalent, or the bigger bookstores that reach more people. And Amazon rankings will influence more people, and the book will be on more people's radar if more people order from Amazon. It's also usually the cheapest. So I would say, whatever drives your purchase power, like I would love it if you go support the local neighborhood bookstore and pre-order from them, and that might put it on their radar. Maybe they weren't even planning to carry it, but you want to pre-order. They'll go, oh, okay, I'll order a couple more. We'll put 3 in the store. That's helpful. If you order from a major bookstore like Barnes & Noble in the US or Chapters in Canada, I'm trying to name drop, I hope I got it right. Then that's a great approach too. And obviously, for full transparency, like 75% of all book sales come from Amazon. They're so big. Mm-hmm. And that also helps our rankings, and you can put reviews on there, and if you order from there, you're a verified purchaser, which makes your review stand out more and all that stuff. But it's totally up to you, the listener, and the potential reader. And what I would say though, is that pre-orders matter. My last book made a bunch of bestseller lists, and I'd like to do the same with this even more important book than The Plant-Based Athlete. Quite frankly, it is. The Impactful Vegan is just better. It's a more enjoyable read. It's more informational. It's educational. It's just a wonderful book. That, you know, those kind of things like online reviews and everything matter. So, but also like the pre-orders matter, because that gives us a chance to try to make some of those lists in the first place, which gives us more media, more exposure, more titles to be able to say, hey, this book is a, you know, blah, blah, blah bestseller, whatever that list is, whether it, you know, it's a long shot to make the New York Times with this one, a book that has vegan in the title. And it's about, you know, donating money, time, and effort, which people don't want to do any of those. So like I joked with another author, like, she's like, Robert, like you're asking people to do things that nobody wants to do. You know, like when you have like a weight loss book, like everybody wants to lose weight, right? Mm-hmm. Or a cookbook, everybody wants new recipes. And I'm saying, yeah, open up your heart, mind, and your wallet and donate to these effective charities. And oh, by the way, change your behavior, change your purchasing power, give stuff away. Like it's more than that, obviously. But I'm asking people to be thoughtful and generous and altruistic. And, you know, does that translate to book sales? I guess we'll find out on July 1st when the bestseller lists come out, if I'm on any of them.
Well, I think you deserve to be on them regardless. So I'm very excited. And I'll definitely, everyone listening, I'll have this podcast out before the release. So pre-order, I'll link to everything in the show notes below. Is there anywhere specific personally you want to direct people to? Or I'll link to your Instagram, your website and all that. But
yeah, I've got a brand new website, impactfulvegan.com.
Yes, I found it. It's beautiful, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. So I'm just now starting. In fact, I haven't even said this. I should start saying this. What am I doing? I haven't said this in any podcast, but you can actually go request a free chapter.
Oh, amazing. Yes, I saw that.
Go to the website, request, and I actually emailed my publisher today to make sure they're doing it, because I'm going to Toronto with a big audience like this weekend. I want to make sure when I announce that mm-hmm. from the stage that, you know, people actually do get their free chapter. So yes, go to impactfulvegan.com, request your free chapter. And also when you pre-order, no matter where you are in the world, doesn't matter what country or where you are, everybody gets hundreds of dollars worth of bonuses because they're all digital bonuses. They're bonus eBooks, they're bonus courses, they're bonus cookbooks, and they are from contributors who are interviewed in the book. You know, like Chef AJ and Ella Majors and Drina Burton, and all these kind of people that were interviewed for the book. They offered a bunch of very generous free digital products. I also have a bunch of my eBooks in there that you get when you pre-order. So like you literally spend like $20 or $30 on the book and you get hundreds of dollars in bonuses and you can get a free chapter all from going to, I think it's impactfulvegan.com. I don't think it's the, I think it's just impactfulvegan.com.
Okay. Amazing. Definitely. I will link to it below. Robert, you are a pleasure to talk to. I'm very excited. I am going to make changes in my own advocacy. I'm sure of it after reading this. And even after just like our conversation today, I loved the leaving the note at the restaurants when you eat, being like, I ate here because you have vegan options. Like that's so simple, but makes an impact. So it's things like that I think I'm excited to learn more. I learn something every time I talk to you, and thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you, Cass. And really, there are tips like that, little things like those little, all throughout the book. And that's what I'm so excited about, because I want to see the result of this book. I want to see like, oh, wow, now plant-based product sales went up after Robert's book came out. And not so I can take credit. It's because I want the system to work. Mm-hmm. I want it to come together collectively and make that difference where donations go up, plant-based product sales go up, innovation goes up, feedback goes up. The most effective strategies are implemented. That's the whole point of writing the book. And so if that happens, and you just beautifully already stated a couple things that you took away just from this 82-minute conversation, then that's wonderful. So thank you, Cass. Appreciate you as always.
Amazing. Well, enjoy your time in Toronto. I hope you get good weather out there.
That's snowing
and,
right now.
So. Safe travels and all the best. Thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
That's all for now. Thank you for listening, and I hope it was valuable to you. Please remember to check out the show notes for all the resources mentioned and links to connect with our guest. If you would like to support what I'm doing, the best way to help me grow the show is to subscribe, of course, but also share it with your friends and family or on social media. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, you can also leave a 5-star review and or a comment. A special thank you, as always, to Tyler Gatto for composing the theme music for the podcast, and to Wyatt Pavlik for the excellent audio engineering each and every episode. So until next time, keep training hard, keep eating plants, and take care.